Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient, and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees, so I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in 2 orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply.
I'm doing fine, Justin. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So what are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Tonight we're talking about the Beast of British Columbia, also known as Clifford Olson. Clifford Olson was a career criminal responsible for possession of firearms, committing fraud, theft, armed robbery, forgery, rape, and murder. His killing spree, at least the killing spree that we know of, lasted from November of 1980 through July of 1981, claiming 11 young victims. His victims ranged in age from 9 years old to 18 years old.
The ones that we know of range from there, but we suspect there could be more that could be even younger.
We'll start by talking about some of the victims here. In November of 1980, in Surrey, British Columbia, a 12-year-old named Christine Weller, who lived with her parents in the Bonanza Motel, was hanging out with friends at the Surrey Place Mall. At some point, she realizes it's 5 o'clock and she needs to get home. So she borrows a bike from a friend to get home quickly. It's about 3 minutes by bike to get to where she lives from where she's at. She doesn't make it home. Her parents don't really suspect any trouble because they assume she's just staying with a friend. Days go by and her parents then believe that she's just run away.
Police will discover her bicycle behind an animal hospital.
And at this point, they suspect foul play. On December 25th, Christmas Day, a man walking his dog discovers her body at the back of a dump. She had been strangled with a belt and stabbed multiple times.
The next year, April 16th, 1981, 13-year-old Colleen Daigneau, she was a shy teen living with her grandmother. She had stayed the night at a friend's house and was due back around 4 o'clock the next day. She never arrives. Her grandmother assumes she's staying longer, but after a few days, she'll be reported missing. 5 days after Colleen goes missing, Darren Johnsrud will go missing. He had arrived in Vancouver 2 days earlier. Because it was such a short amount of time to be there, it was obvious that he had not run away and that this was foul play.
Sandra Wolfsteiner was 16 years old. She was at a bus stop. She went missing May 19th, 1981. Ada Court, 13 years old. She went missing June 21st, 1981. She was walking on North Road in Coquitlam when she was abducted.
July 2nd, 1981, 9-year-old Simon Partington went missing. That morning, he got up, ate breakfast, got dressed, and was heading out on his bicycle to a friend's house. He'll disappear just blocks from where Christine Weller went missing.
14-year-old Judy Cosma was abducted July 9th, 1981. Near Weaver Lake. Ray King Jr., 15 years old, in July of 1981. He was picked up at a bus depot.
And the police assume that he's a runaway. They say, no, there was no signs of problems at home. He wasn't depressed. There was no issues here. But it's kind of a running theme with a lot of these teenagers.
Sigrun Arndt, 18 years old.
A exchange student from Germany. She disappears July 1981.
Witnesses saw her with a strange man, both at a pub and later on a train.
2 days later, Terry Lynn Carson, 15 years old.
Terry was headed to the bus stop to catch a ride to the Guildford Mall. People say that she was going to apply for a job at a pet shop, but she disappears from the bus stop.
Then just a few days later, Louise Chartrand, 17 years old. Goes missing.
They believe that she was hitchhiking to get to her waitress job. Her co-workers at Bino's restaurant called her family after she didn't show up for her shift, and the family reported her missing the next morning.
There was a teenage boy named Randy Ludlow. He was hanging out with Clifford Olson. He had met Clifford because Randy's father was part of a boxing gym. Clifford said he knew his father from the boxing gym, and turned out to be true. He hung out with him on several occasions. He would show off to Randy. It was in July of 81. He was in Clifford's car, and they offered a young girl a ride, give him alcohol, things like that. But Clifford would drop Ludlow off at a mall and then leave with a young girl who looked very much like Judy Cosma. A little bit later, Randy would be with Clifford again, and they would pick up a few teenage girls on the roadside. And then a few minutes later, an unmarked police car pulled them over, arrested Clifford at gunpoint, and took him away. Randy and the other teens were left on the side of the road with no explanation. A few days later, Clifford would reappear and say that there was a misunderstanding and that they were more than happy to let him out once they realized who he was. Randy would just take Clifford's word for this. But once reports of these missing children, Randy himself would get himself into trouble with having possessions of knives and different criminal acts. And he would tell police that he suspects Clifford. But law enforcement would say that they already had their eyes on him and had him under observation. But even during this time, four more children would go missing. So who is Clifford?
Clifford Olson was born January 1st, 1940. If you're born on New Year's Day, you might appear in the paper. Apparently, her mother wouldn't want to be in the paper with her new baby because she hadn't yet been married to Clifford's father, Clifford Sr. His mother's name is Leona. But at that time, back in 1940, it was frowned upon.
Living in sin.
Yeah, a woman giving birth to a child by a man she wasn't married to. Clifford Sr. was in the military. He would end up marrying her when he returned. When Clifford was born, he had emergency surgery because he had a stomach blockage, and it left a scar on his stomach that looked like it was made by a slash from a knife. At age four, his 15-year-old uncle started to play games with Clifford and his cousin, who was a young girl. The uncle would strip off his clothing and ask the kids to take their clothes off. And then he would play a game where he would lay on them one at a time. And when he was done, he would reward them with something, usually a nickel. Very, very strange. Around this time, he discovered the benefits of scamming people. On one occasion, his mother and her brothers were drinking, and they ran out of beer. Clifford says, "Hey, I can get you more." His mom was like, "What?" But her brothers were like, "Well, hold on. Let's see what the young guy can do." And he said, "What'll happen if I can get you some more beers?" And they said, "Oh, we'll give you a dollar." So he went downstairs and filled up empty beer bottles with water and used a hammer to hammer the caps back on. So he brings these bottles back upstairs and everybody is really excited. They're like, "Wow, I can't believe you found some beer. Here's your dollar." And of course, they find out they've been scammed. But they don't get pissed off. They actually think this is cool. And they tell Clifford as much. They say, "Wow, you are really crafty. And you're so clever." At about age six, Clifford begins to steal. When he steals money, he'll use that money to pay for things for his peers. He would go into people's gardens and then take the flowers or the vegetables. He would take them around to the front door and sell them at a really cheap price. And they'd say, "Wow, that's a deal." But it came from their backyard. In his early teens, he was stealing money from milkmen. His dad was a milkman after the war. And in fact, they say his dad was one of the last milkmen to actually use a horse-drawn cart. But because he knew where his dad kept his money on the cart, he knew where everyone else, likely where they kept their money on their carts. So he would go around and either steal money that was left for the milkmen from the houses, or he would sneak up to the carts when the milkman was delivering and steal jars of money from the carts. And this would continue on. He started branching out, finding new ways to scam people or impress people with his stolen money. Clifford was on the small side. Yeah, as an adult, he would end up at 5'7", 159 pounds or so. He was often bullied. And at some point, he decides that he's had enough of the bullying and he joins a gym and starts boxing. And his dad says that his son started boxing so he could get back at the bullies who had beaten him up. After he starts sharpening his boxing skills, he starts going after the very people that had bullied him and taking them on.
I read some reports that as a teen, he tortured animals, but I couldn't verify any of it. It was just articles that were written out there, and there's a lot of junk articles about this guy out there.
Yeah, they say he tortured animals, but I've also heard that he actually really liked dogs, so it doesn't seem likely that he tortured dogs. But again, there's a lot of information out there that seems sort of unverified. At age 16, he drops out of school. He was supposed to be in eighth grade, and he works at a racetrack. But he loses that job because he's forging checks
16 years old and he's forging already. At 17, he is arrested for breaking and entering and actually has to go to jail for it. But after a short amount of time, he escapes.
Yeah, this is in 1965. He starts complaining that he has trouble urinating, that he's dehydrated. He's basically saying he has a kidney issue. And so a doctor asks for a urine sample, and he pricks his finger and drops blood into the sample so that the doctor will send him out. And it works. He's taken to a hospital. And while he's there, he has a guard, and they're in the waiting room. But the guard, I don't know if the guard's getting bored or is new at this, but he ends up taking off Clifford's handcuffs. And then he leaves to go find the doctor because it's just taking too long. Clifford just walks out.
Because of this escape, they're going to add more time to his sentence. And he will end up escaping up to 7 more times by swindling, lying, and just making his way.
There's one point where he literally walks out of a prison, and a man who was walking by talks to the guard and says, "Wow, that's one happy guy that just walked out of here." And the guard says, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "Yeah, this guy that just walked past me, I mean, he's a free man now. He seems really happy." And the guard says, "We didn't release anyone today." And he goes, "Well, you have one less now than you know." Clifford will spend more time in prison. We're not going to go through everything that happens in prison because it's extensive. To give you some perspective on just the numbers that we're dealing with this guy, from the age of 17 through 41, there were only about 4 years where he wasn't in prison. And he had nearly 100 different charges brought against him. In fact, this guy's whole life is extensive. You could write multiple books about certain years of his life. That's how ridiculous it is, how much information is out there about what he was into, who he was traveling around with.
But he does end up in a Supermax for assaulting a young girl. Ends up befriending somebody at that Supermax.
Gary Marcoux was no stranger to prison. He had been paroled after serving 5 years for the rape of his own 18-year-old sister. They say he raped his little sister as well, who was very young. But they didn't have enough evidence because the girl couldn't testify. She's too young to talk about this kind of stuff. But he was seen playing with a 9-year-old girl because he was living in a halfway house next to her house. Her body would be found. They say that she had been raped, mutilated, and strangled and tied to a tree in a camping area at Weaver Lake. Because there were witnesses that said they saw Gary with this young girl, he is the prime suspect in this 9-year-old's murder. He knows that he needs an alibi. And he asks Clifford, "Hey, can you help me with this? Can you give me an alibi?" Clifford thinks about it and says, "When did this happen?" And they're talking about it. And Clifford's like, "Oh, yeah, I think I could say that we were hanging out together." So he tells Gary, "Okay, I'm really going to be putting my neck out for you. So you have to do something for me." And of course, Gary's all too happy to help him, because it's going to possibly get him out of this murder charge. Clifford says, "You need to give me a full write-up on exactly what happened. I need to know everything. That way I know how to tailor the alibi." And so they start working together. Gary starts feeding him all the information. Meanwhile, what Clifford is doing is he's actually taking all this information down, and he's going to basically stab Gary in the back. He's going to turn this over so that he will definitely be charged with this young girl's murder.
Clifford's manipulating the situation so he can take credit.
Well, Gary Marcoux's lawyer tells him, "Yeah, you just need to plead guilty now. They have all this information on you, and they have letters written in your own handwriting. It's a confession. We don't have any way to fight this." So he does plead guilty. They give him a sentence of 25 years with no parole.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles, and immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
I want to go through some things that had happened with Clifford while he was in prison and during some of his escapes. There's a team of dogs that were used to capture him, Rinty and Tiger. In 1964, Rinty finds Clifford. Clifford was hiding in some blackberry bushes in Richmond, and Rinty tracks him down and finds him. Just a year later, he is on the run again, and he digs in the ground and makes sort of a shallow depression, and then he pulls a bunch of leaves over himself, and he was probably under the leaves for about 3 hours. And Tiger is indicating that there's something in the leaves. And even then, the police are like, what's with this dog? There's nothing here. They're standing all around him, and they don't realize that he's laying there. The dog is getting more worked up. And finally, Clifford kind of comes out of the leaves somewhat and just says, I give up.
You got me.
That's when he gets 7 years in prison. Now, while he's in prison, there are some things that occur, one of which is, he is not afraid to rat people out. And as we know, in prison, it's against code. You don't turn against the other prisoners. You deal with the other prisoners
by yourself on your own terms. It's you against the guards, or it's the prisoners against the guards and the warden.
And so he actually ratted out some drug couriers. And of course, this makes him look really good to the prison. They think he's great.
They give him extra benefits and favors.
And he has to be protected now because, well, he's a rat. And this would actually follow him whichever prison he went to, because he was transferred around. While in prison, he also, I don't know if suffers the right word, but he has insomnia. And the prison doctor prescribes chloral hydrate pills. Now, in 1976, while he's at the Prince Albert Penitentiary, Olson is sitting around and another prisoner says, hey, we're going to go play some cards. Do you want to go? And Clifford doesn't have anything going on, so he's like, sure, why not? Well, he starts playing cards. One guy that's there starts saying, how do you guys feel about playing with a rat? Clifford doesn't care for this at all and says, you must be a rat for saying that. Well, the tension escalates, and the guy says, you should cash out or you're a rat. Basically saying, like, you need to go. Clifford can tell that there are some men there that are ready to hurt him. He's being set up. So he makes a run for it, and he starts boxing these guys essentially while they try to kick him down and slash at him with a pair of scissors and a knife. He will get away from them. He is taken to Holy Family Hospital, but they say that he's not really hurt. I mean, he's cut, he's stabbed, but he's angry. And the warden, along with a Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer, meet with him. They don't expect to get anything out of Clifford because, again, he's a prisoner. Prisoners don't talk. Clifford has no problem talking about what happened. He said he wants something done about it. Well, they're going to bring attempted murder charges against 4 men. Now, charges against two of the men stick. This, of course, only cements him as someone who is, he does not follow the prison code at all. In fact, the Saskatchewan Criminal Injuries Compensation Board notices that Clifford files with them and they award him money for his injuries, $3,500.
This is just the start of an ongoing pattern of his time in prisons where he will complain about conditions, will sue different departments and for cruel and unusual punishment.
Now, the board, they kind of see this incident as their fault in a way because Clifford is doing the right thing. He ratted out the drug couriers. What they understand happened is some prisoners had gotten into his cell and found some notes that he had taken on these drug couriers. And so this was retribution. Well, he was basically acting as an informant for the prison, so they feel like they owe him. But he's aligning himself not with the prisoners, but with the prison and the guards. And it's all about, hey, what is Clifford going to get out of this? Because now, of course, the prisons will protect him. They'll separate him from the other prisoners. In 1980, Olson is released from prison. And soon after, he meets a woman who's recently divorced named Joan Hale. Part of her divorce settlement was that she received $43,000.
Clifford will claim it's only $28,000, but there's a discrepancy there.
Clifford could be very charming or very cold to her. In the beginning, he really won her over and even said that he knew her father, who was in a prison. But he would not approach her home. He would wait outside in a vehicle to pick her up. And her stepdad would always tell her, hey, that's not right. That's not how this is supposed to work. A young man should always come to the front door to pick up his date. And eventually he would have to just have her meet him down the street or something. I mean, it wasn't working out between her boyfriend and her stepdad.
They'll get married on May 15th, 1981 at the People's Full Gospel Chapel in Surrey, a month after their son Stephen is born. By the time they're married, he's killed three children that we know of. Within days of their wedding, he will go on to murder Sandra Wolfsteiner.
While he's out, they're going to church regularly. And anybody who met him there says, this is a good Christian man. He talks about the Bible. He talks about God. He's even posting jobs for teenagers at the church.
This is how he would entice some of these teenagers to go with him, is he would drive around with pamphlets in his car or business cards that were flashy, and he would offer rides to hitchhikers or anyone that would get into his car and then say, hey, I know of a job. I run a cleaning business. And most of the kids that lived up there, they're always looking for work. They're always looking for extra money. So they would agree to go along with him. And at that point, he would offer them alcohol. He would take them to a non-existent job site. And then he would end up getting them drunk, drugging them, and then attacking them. That was his typical MO.
Or he'll offer these pills to young people that are with him in the vehicle who have been drinking, and he'll say, these are wake-up pills, chloral hydrate pills. They'll help you wake up so you're not so drunk. And of course, that will cause them to get knocked out.
He learned that from prison. Some websites refer to him as a homosexual pedophile. He had no preference in his victim besides he preyed on both boys and girls.
And it was most likely an opportunity thing because the younger people he could overpower, and he was also very charming when he needed to be. He would drive around, and then he would get a young girl in his car, and he would say, oh, where are you going? And he would end up offering them a job and offer them a rate of pay that was just crazy. If the minimum wage is $3.50 an hour, and he's offering them $10 an hour, are they going to turn that down? And then it's not just ending there. It's not just, oh, I'll drop you off and then we'll get together later and you can start working. No, it's I'll pay you $10 an hour and let's go out to eat to celebrate.
Let's go right now.
They're ready to make some good money. And $10 an hour back in the early 80s, that's pretty good money. Only he doesn't take them home.
after his arrest in August of 81, this is when they started to piece together who he was. They found an address book, and in there they found Judy Cosman's name. They move on him, but they have zero evidence. They're unable to find any of the possessions of these victims on him, even though he actually would keep many trophies, as he would call them, from his victims. They weren't able to find any of that, so they have very little evidence. They interrogate him for several days. They actually move him from different jails, doing everything they can to make him uncomfortable, not allowing him to sleep, and just switching off, tag teaming on the interviews. He won't break, but as soon as there's mention of money, that sparks his interest. And it truly is unclear if he's the one that brought this up or if the investigators were the ones that brought that up. In their desperation, they're thinking they got nothing on this guy, but they know that he's responsible for at least some of these missing children and murders. They found four bodies that they're pretty sure are his. They actually have found more bodies, but there's four of them that they are honed in on. And they make him an offer. And this goes up to the Attorney General, Alan Williams, and they write up a hasty contract with him. And this is how it goes. This is an undertaking of an agreement between the RCMP and Clifford Robert Olson. The following will be paid by the RCMP to Mrs. Joan Olson for the following information. 10,000 cash for each body of the missing persons, up to seven bodies. $30,000 for information of four bodies which have already been recovered, which can relate to the above seven other missing persons. The agreement should be as undertaken, shall be binding in law, as to not disclose this information in this agreement to the Canadian press. The following missing persons are covered in this agreement, and then they list out his victims. This money will go to a trust, which then will be paid out to his wife. They're paying him for confessions. They're paying him so they have something, because right now they don't have anything and they're desperate. That's what the Attorney General will say. That's what most of the law enforcement will say. But they're in a very particular situation, very bad situation. They know this guy's a killer, a child killer, the worst of the worst. The public outrage against him is off the charts. This is their excuse for handing this man money.
Yeah, they can close the cases. They can return the remains to the families. Inexpensive investigation can be shut down. And a monster is behind bars. That's what they're looking at here. Is it worth $100,000?
I never would want to negotiate with a terrorist. I would never want to pay for these things. Because, I mean, how valid is it? I mean, if they give them the money and then none of it pans out. But they take the chance. And just how wasteful our governments are, you know, what's $100,000 to the government? You know, it doesn't go to him. It's totally controlled by the trust fund and his wife. But he gets this money, and then he starts flying around with his lawyer, Robert Chance, detectives, and a whole forensics team. They will go out to different locations, and he will gleefully reenact the murders for these investigators and tell them exactly how it went down, play it out. The investigators said this was the weirdest thing they've ever experienced. It was very off-putting to them, which obviously when you're going to collect a child's body and you have the murderer right there who's playing along, it's very uncomfortable. They actually pay him. They're in a downtown building in an upstairs meeting room. And according to his lawyer, he's up there, no cuffs on, smoking a cigar, dictating to a room full of lawyers what his terms are as they're counting out stacks of cash for his wife. It's the most absurd scene I could ever imagine.
And this is why the families of these murdered young people are so pissed off. I mean, they're so angry about this that money is basically being traded for information on what happened and where the remains are. That's why they call it a cash for bodies deal. And it just doesn't sit right with them.
It's unsubstantiated, but he claims he knows where 20 more bodies are, and he's trying to pull another deal for another $100,000. But when the media catches wind of this, they hear that he's flying out of Kingston to Victoria, and the journalists are on the way, the paparazzi's on the way. So the plane was about to taxi out, and then they go back in and they jump in a cop car, and then there's a chase where media and journalists are chasing the cops with this serial killer in the car. It just, how can it get to this level? And as much as they wanted to get this man off the streets, what did the attorney general expect to happen when they made this deal? And they say it's the deal with the devil.
I don't think that they foresaw this. They didn't have any idea that this guy would play them again. The way he saw it, I think, was it's another opportunity to make good, you know, for himself. It's really obvious now that they had no idea that he was going to do this, that he was going to say, oh, I have more bodies I can tell you about, more victims. Before this, he had written letters that indicated other victims.
Many victims that he only sexually assaulted, didn't murder. Many other children that he was around in his past that they're pretty sure that he had molested. This guy now turns around in court and pleads guilty to 10 murders, but then the prosecutor lumps one more on. So that's how we get the 11th. And he pleads guilty to that one too.
Because of the pressure with the media breathing down their necks, detectives, they're done. They can't deal with this anymore. They can't do another cash for bodies deal because this is just killing their reputation. And we're talking about the Royal Canadian Mounted Police here. They can't afford to have their reputation go down the toilet because of the serial killer.
Well, that's the way the public looks at it, is they say, well, if you were doing it right, you would have the evidence against this man, and then we wouldn't have to pay him off to get him to confess.
It depends on how you see this. Do you see this as a cheat code? If you've ever played like Nintendo and you could type in a certain code and you could get infinite lives or something, this is where they literally cheated to get to the end. So they got confessions. They know exactly how these people were killed. They know where the remains were left. And all they had to do was pay $100,000 into a trust fund that would go to this killer's wife. They could keep doing this, I suppose. But on the other hand, you have families who are saying, how dare you, instead of just investigating, instead of doing your job, you're just paying the killer to get the information. Why would you give that man money? He shouldn't have any money.
Clifford's not helping the situation because he has contacted the media himself, told the media about the cash for bodies deal he got. He writes very inflammatory letters about the victims and the victims' families, and the newspapers will publish these letters, so causing more stress on the victims' families. The Rosenfelds, parents of Darren Johnsrud, were sued by Clifford because they called him a pedophile. He will send them a letter on Darren's anniversary of when they found his body. In this letter, Clifford Olson will detail the torture their son endured. He will go on to write that their son's last words were, "Why are you doing this to me?" The Rosenfelds will go on to start a victims' rights movement and lobby the federal government to legislate laws to protect victims' families from this kind of behavior. Clifford Olson, he files multiple complaints of cruel and unusual punishment.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. How can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
One of them, he claims he's being denied a solid pleasure, life-size inflatable sex doll. He wants it installed with plexiglass in front of his cell. These are the frivolous things he's doing the entire time he's behind bars. He will be sentenced 11 life sentences, which account for 25 years apiece that run concurrently. That means they run all at the same time. And as we know with Canadian law and punishment, you get time served for stuff, you can get your sentence reduced. In 1997, he applies for early parole under a Faith Hope clause, which allows prisoners to seek release after just 15 years of a life sentence. So life doesn't mean life. Life is 25 and they can file after 15. And of course he does this. And this has to be called to a hearing. All the victims' families have to be notified. In 2006, he appears before the National Parole Board. He's spent 25 years in prison. They reject his application for parole. But each time, again, the victims' families have to be notified, show up, speak against it. In 2010, it's also reported that he's been collecting $1,100 to $1,200 a month in a security retirement supplement plan. So inmates that turn 65 are eligible for this, and he's been collecting. This goes viral, and the public is not happy. So the federal government literally introduces a new law that suspends benefits for prisoners until after they're released. So if he were to ever be paroled, that's when the payments will come out. But as long as he's in prison, he cannot collect. But up until that point, he was getting over $1,000 a month. He applies for parole a third time, but is denied. This is the problem here, though, is he is eligible for parole. He could be released. He made a side comment to one of the officers, "If I get out, I'm going to pick up right where I left off." He's a psychopath. And as much as people say, well, there was no chance of him getting out, there was a chance. But did the government learn their lesson after all the crap he stirred up, all the publications he made? Hopefully they learned their lesson and would never let this man out. But I'm questioning. He's in prison. He gets cancer. He's 70-something years old. Well, they might say, well, now it's just cruel and there's an old man in prison that's dying of cancer. He's no harm to anybody. We should let him out. That could happen. And that's the sick and scary part about all of this. In September 2011, he will get colon cancer and die in prison. And all the families of all the victims are very, very happy. In fact, most of Canada is celebrating this. His lawyer was given death threats for simply representing him. His wife went into hiding because the victims' families tried to sue for the money, the $100,000. And this went all the way up to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court said, sorry, this isn't going to happen. And they allowed the wife to keep all the money. So this is blow after blow to the victims. As much as I hate to say it, but Clifford won the entire time. He manipulated everybody he was around. He manipulated the system. He got credit for putting another child murderer behind bars. He was able to get paroled, find a wife, live a life. Then he goes to prison, and it's on his terms, really. He's able to manipulate the system, get paid, and then go on to collect a retirement payout. I mean, this is insanity to me. And then he gets to die in prison peacefully. All the people that surrounded him, all their lives are affected, whether it be the victims' families, teenager Randy Ludlow. He is considered an accessory, an associate of Clifford's. People think that he was helping Clifford with capturing or enticing these teenagers. The Vancouver newspapers went after Ludlow, but it's really all hearsay. I want to hope that the media would be a little bit more balanced, but if you have an association with a child murderer, the gloves are off. If you are called an accessory to that, there's nothing you can say or do to fight that. His lawyer, people hate him. He's a lawyer. He defends people. He's defended a lot of really bad characters out there, but he's a defense lawyer. That's what he does.
He'll report that even his children would get death threats or bullied in school because of who he is.
He'll get out of defense law practice.
He drops it. He doesn't want to do it anymore. Joan, Clifford's wife,
they say that she had to have known, she had to have been part of it, and she profited off of it. In his profile, he writes a letter. His entire motivation for confessing these crimes and getting this money was to take care of the wife that he loved. He is such a liar, and everything that comes out of his mouth is such garbage. He's such a manipulator that even then, can we take him for his word that he was doing something good for society because he was a loving husband? I mean, that's really where he goes here, is he confessed and got the money for his wife. And that's the whole reason why he confessed. Otherwise, he wouldn't have confessed at all. One of the trials during this time, he had drawn a graphic picture of a child in a sexual act and waved it above his head so the victim's family sitting behind him would see it.
When you have a serial killer, you always want to look back and say, what happened? What led to this behavior or to this pattern of murder? And with Clifford, it seemed as though it was his personality. I mean, this is just the way he was. Everything he did was all about making himself feel good. And whether that was by making other people feel good or his taking pleasure in hurting other people or scamming them, it was well known that he didn't like to work. Work was for suckers. That's why he robbed people. That's why he would go to elderly people's homes or apartments and ask for change or ask to use the phone or ask for a glass of water. And of course, when they would turn their back and walk away, he would go right where they kept their money. He knew where to look, whether it was a cabinet, a drawer, or sometimes, you know, they just left their purse on the counter. And he would just rifle through it. He really just served himself. People that have looked into his past, looked into the crimes that he committed, they say that it's really that simple. He just does not have a conscience. And it's like the world's his playground. He would escape from a prison just because he wanted to. He didn't care if he got caught in an hour or in 10 minutes or if he got away. That was life. It was a challenge. It was, let's do this now. Let's just suddenly do this. That makes him a very difficult killer to track down. And that's probably why they had so much trouble with him. is he would rent various rental cars. He would travel to different areas. And there are probably a good number of victims that they could never tie to him because, well, on one hand, they couldn't make any more deals with him. That was definitely off the table. And even though he had sort of confessed to some other murders, they need more than that. They're caught in a place where they know this guy has likely committed many more murders than the 11 that were attributed to him. And he's just going to get away with those. But people don't always find the answers they're looking for. And in this case, we don't really have the answer to why he was the way he was, other than you can look back at his past and see how he escalated from being a scammer to a thief, to a rapist, to a murderer. And along the way, he had assistance. He had assistance from people that didn't know what to do with him. They just say, we don't have enough evidence on this guy. Or his own mother, who would say, oh, you stole this money. I'm not going to tell your dad. When was he going to be held accountable? And it seems like for much of his life, he really wasn't. And then even when he was arrested, the charges didn't seem that bad. I mean, you know, if he had 12 counts of theft or robbery, they netted the same sentence as if he had committed one, because it all runs concurrent. At no point does it feel like he was actually held responsible. And even when they make this deal with him, the public is looking at this cash for bodies deal and they don't see it as a resolution. They feel cheated. They feel like their loved ones died and the person was rewarded for it.
Absolutely.
So whether you can look at this just on a pure number standpoint and see how they probably got off cheap paying him, there's a whole other angle to this, which is the emotional angle. These are people's families at stake here. Their loved ones have been brutally murdered. And, you know, Justin and I haven't gotten into the real nitty gritty details of it. But if you want to know those things, you can find them out because, you know, this killer left behind manuscripts and it was turned into a book. You can read the details of what he did, but they're horrifying. And that's the real lesson here is, in Canada, before Robert Picton, before Carla Homolka and Paul Bernardo, there was this killer.
And he had a book deal while he was in prison, too.
His victims probably, you know, if we want to talk about murdered and non-murder victims, hundreds at least. And so I think you've already said it once, Justin, but this is very much a case where the bad guy seems like he won.
It was all on his terms. The only thing that wasn't was getting colon cancer. So I can only hope that gave him some amount of suffering.
I would suggest if you want to know more about the entire backstory on this case, and there's a lot of it, start reading. Just as Neil said, this guy was a waste of Canadian air. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries, and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.